I'm Alice O'Sullivan, guest host of Your Legal Rights. Chuck Finney is taking a well-deserved vacation day. My guests this evening are both specialists in workers' compensation certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and both are leaders in the California Applicants Attorneys Association, which we will refer to as CAW. Crystal Schoenfelder is a partner in the Ontario law firm of Rose, Klein & Marius and is the co-founder and co-chair of the CAW Women's Caucus. Jason Marcus is a partner in the Sacramento law firm of Marcus, Regalado & Marcus and is a board member of CAW. He also, I found this information not from Jason but from my good friend Lester Friedman, has been named the Young Attorney of the Year by the State Bar's Workers' Compensation Section. Jason will be receiving this award at the October Convention of the State Bar. Tonight is also our Call a Lawyer Night for those of you listening live or streaming us live at www.kalw.org. You may call 1-800-525-9917 to speak to the attorneys who are giving their time as a public service. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, whose 1,000-plus members statewide represent workers injured at the workplace. And additional funding is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estates Section, the Labor and Employment Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Welcome, Crystal and Jason. We have an exciting program to talk about tonight. We're talking about gender bias in workers' compensation. Crystal, would you want to start and let us know what's been going on with gender bias in work comp?
Sure. And first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate on this program. It is a very important topic. So gender bias in California's workers' compensation system can be blatant. It can be seen once you sort of scratch the surface away, or sometimes it just reinforces the current gender biases that we have in society. I am fortunate to be one of the co-chairs of CAW Women's Caucus, and we are leading the fight to eliminate gender bias in workers' compensation.
How does gender bias manifest itself in workers' comp?
There are a variety of examples that we do want to discuss. We have found in discussing gender bias with both men and women, it has truly been an enlightening experience. And it is something that has not been exposed very much.
Well, I think you're right. I know we've had several programs on workers' comp, and I don't remember in any program discussing gender bias before.
Now, being a woman should not be a pre-existing condition or a penalty that would allow reduction of workers' compensation for an injury on the job.
And maybe you could explain to me how this, what are you talking about when you talk about reduction in workers' comp? Is that something that we refer to as apportionment?
Correct. So we have some allies in this fight, and one of them is Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez, and she is introducing a bill, which is AB 305. Now, as a disclosure, the bill language is currently undergoing some changes in the draft language, and so without actually saying what the bill currently says, the gist of it, though, is that it would outlaw a doctor being able to reduce women's permanent disability compensation due to pregnancy, menopause, osteoporosis, and in sexual harassment cases.
And by you're saying a doctor reducing this, Jason, could you enlighten us a little bit as to how that works, what the doctor's opinion has to do with people's getting money for their injury?
Certainly, and just like Crystal said, I just want to start by thanking you for inviting me onto the program. It's always a treat to speak with you, and I agree that Chuck gets a well-deserved night off tonight.
So, things.
You used a word a moment ago, apportionment, which is a big legal word. It really boils down to causation. Specifically, in the workers' compensation system, we have a benefit that we call permanent disability that is supposed to compensate someone who has been hurt on the job for the permanent residual effects from the injury. Maybe it's loss of use of a part of their body, loss of strength, loss of range of motion, whatever it may be. We have doctors that evaluate the workers and try to quantify, that is, put a number, a percentage, to give a relative value for that particular worker's permanent disability. As part of that process, the law currently requires that a doctor tell the parties of the permanent disability that the doctor has identified how much of that is due to the work injury and how much, if any, is due to other factors, things other than the work injury. And it's that parsing out, in other words, how much to the job, how much to things other than the job, that we call apportionment. And as to the specific issue of gender bias, what we have seen in looking at not only our cases, my cases, Crystal's, but talking to other CA members, other attorneys who represent injured workers throughout the state, is we found a number of times where a doctor has apportioned some portion of a permanent disability award to factors that are related to gender. And that's what we're really trying to get at with this push to eliminate gender bias.
And Crystal, the things that you were talking about, the pregnancy, menopause, that sort of thing, those are the kinds of things that doctors are now saying a woman gets less money because they may be in menopause or they may be pregnant. Is that the idea?
Correct. So a couple examples from actual reports. I have the quotes. These are all by doctors who have been appointed by the state as panel qualified medical evaluators. So in one case, the doctor said she has common and generally recognized non-occupation risk factors, including her age, gender, and non-industrial hand use. And I would apportion 20% to those risk factors. So that would mean a 20% reduction of benefits for essentially being an older woman. Same thing with the shoulder tendonitis. A doctor said calcific deposits in the rotator cuff tendons are common in women and often associated with rotator cuff tendonitis. It is my opinion that her occupational exposure with the employer and her innate genetic predisposition to degenerative changes contribute equally to her left shoulder impairment. And in that case, the woman's benefits were reduced by 50%, essentially because she was an older woman.
Wow, 50%. Now, this would not happen if the injured worker were male. Is that right?
That's correct. That's where it becomes a penalty and a pre-existing condition just for being a woman, because we may have a different anatomical change, for instance, compared to a man.
So basically, you're saying, if I get it right, that women should not be charged more or compensated less simply because of their gender.
Correct. There was one instance where a woman who had confirmed electrodiagnostic studies of bilateral carpal tunnel, she had done a job for 9 years with heavy computer use. Her symptoms began before she got pregnant. She then became pregnant, and then the doctor opined that her bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome has been significantly influenced by her pregnancy and breastfeeding, and only possibly by her work injury. This is a woman who, after she gave birth, has had these symptoms continue of carpal tunnel, bilateral numbness, and trigger finger locking.
Wow. Jason, do you have experience with cases where there's this kind of apportionment?
I do. In fact, I had one just this week where my client's deposition was taken. In other words, the other attorney, the attorney for the insurance company, was asking questions of my client under oath, and they were trying to make an issue out of the fact that my client, who has diagnosed bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome, also happened to get pregnant after the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome. They were trying to come up with evidence that shows that, well, it's really the pregnancy that is causing or aggravating the carpal tunnel syndrome, not the work exposure. That's despite the fact that my client was diagnosed with carpal tunnel prior to becoming pregnant. We have another case in our office, a firefighter who developed breast cancer as a result of the exposure to toxic fumes and other carcinogens as part of her job. And sadly, as a result of that breast cancer, she had to undergo a double mastectomy. So she has lost both of her breasts. And we are trying to get her some sort of compensation for that. And the guides that our system tells us to use to rate these disabilities tells us that my client, who's lost both of her breasts, gets at most a 5% impairment, which we use to factor her disability, a 5% disability for losing both of those breasts, but only if she is a female of childbearing age. And even then, it's a range from 0 to 5% that is left ultimately to the discretion of the physician who evaluates her without a lot of guidance as to how you assign that number. But at most, she's going to get a 5% award for the double mastectomy.
That is egregious. Hold that thought. I want to come back to this. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and the California Applicants Attorneys Association, whose 1,000-plus members statewide represent workers injured at the workplace. Tonight is Call a Lawyer night. We have several attorneys in the studio here ready to take your calls off the air. These attorneys are giving this as a public service. There's absolutely no obligation. And we have in our studio tonight Jeff Hayden, a certified specialist in criminal law, Janet Frankel, a certified specialist in family law, Peter Fortune, certified specialist in legal malpractice law, Nathaniel Bigger, who does landlord-tenant law, Charles Wish, who does employment law, and Ron Rohde, who does patent law, aviation law, lemon law, and does Better Business Bureau arbitration. As often is the case, Leon Baer, a certified specialist in bankruptcy, has made himself available tomorrow, that's Thursday, March 26th, from 8 a.m. to noon at 1-800-477-3111. That's 1-800-477-3111. If you call and the line is busy, please leave a message with your name and phone number for Leon Baer, and he'll return your call. Say that you are a KALW listener. The number for the off-the-air Call a Lawyer people is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. We're back to Crystal and Jason. We're talking about the topic gender bias in workers' compensation. Jason, you were just talking to us about this egregious case where a woman firefighter gets very little for a double mastectomy. Is there some sort of, do firefighters and police officers have some sort of a different rule with regard to apportionment usually?
Well, typically, for many of what we call presumptive injuries, and what I mean by that is there are provisions in the law which say that if a worker in a certain occupation, most often a police officer or a firefighter, comes down with a certain type of injury, often cancer, heart disease, things like that, that the law says that injury is presumed to arise out of their employment, meaning that we don't have to prove often the impossible of what caused the cancer, what caused the heart disease. The law says it's presumed to have occurred on the job, and we do that because of the danger that those folks put themselves in and day out to protect us, and so the legislature affords them that protection. Typically, in those cases, the law almost, not always, but in most cases, also prohibits apportionment in those cases, meaning that regardless of a doctor's findings on how they would break down the cause of the disability, the law says there can be no apportionment in those cases. But the thing I want to point out that I find egregious about our female firefighter client with a double mastectomy getting a 5% is, by contrast in our system, a male who has his prostate removed for any reason, but most often due to prostate cancer, gets a 16% award versus the 5% for losing both breasts. And I have come up with no reason why that is, other than I think there's simply some sort of built-in bias to various elements of the system, and that's one of the things that CA and the legislature are trying to address.
You mentioned the presumptions. Just another example of gender bias within workers' compensation is that, like Jason said, the safety personnel, for very good reason, receive certain presumptions. And one of those presumptions is for the MRSA, M-R-S-A, bacterial infection. It's presumed that it happened on the job if they contract that bacterial infection. They don't have to prove that they contracted it on the job. Now, we have about 96% of firefighters are male. About 88% of police officers are male. The presumption does not apply to the nurses who take over the handling of the patient once the patient crosses the threshold of the hospital door. And we have about 90% of nurses and healthcare workers who are female. They have to prove that they contracted the infection while on the job. Now, this could lead to some invasive questioning by a defense attorney at a deposition, because MRSA is a skin-to-skin infection. It could be questions involving their sex life, for instance. So it's an arbitrary presumption for male-dominated occupations versus no presumption for female-dominated occupations.
And does this bill, that this AB 305, does that address that issue?
It does not, because AB 305 is meant to be very specific. There have been in the past some attempts to pass legislation that would outlaw certain types of apportionment, and unfortunately they did not make it into the law books. And so it was decided to narrowly tailor AB 305 to certain conditions that are essentially going to affect women in a disproportionate way. Now, with the MRSA presumption, we did have a bill. It was AB 2616. It was passed. Unfortunately, the governor did veto that bill. So the arbitrary presumption of male versus female still exists.
Wow. Is there something for our listeners, pardon me, that you could recommend that they do to help this along? I mean, it seems to me that this is really something that needs to be done, that should have been done a while back. It strikes me that the Affordable Care Act has gotten rid of gender bias. It's time to get rid of it in workers' compensation. Do you have recommendations for our listeners? What can they do?
Well, definitely they could talk to their state legislators. It's very important that they hear what is going on if they have been victims of gender bias. Because, again, like I said before, it really is an underexposed situation. And the more that we talk to the legislators, the more we talk to the legislators' staff, the more they're grasping what is going on. We have another ally in Christine Pelosi. She is the chair of the California Democratic Party's Women's Caucus, and she has joined our effort to spotlight and eliminate gender bias. We have constructed a resolution that so far the Women's Caucus of the California Democratic Party has unanimously passed, and other party county committees across the state have passed the resolution, essentially saying that the Democratic Party declares that workers' compensation insurance is an issue that disproportionately impacts women, and that policymakers should be urged to make California work better for working women by promoting workplace equality and modernizing workers' compensation laws to correct gender-based discriminatory policies. Now, CAUSE Women's Caucus has set up a website to go to for more information. That website is www.womenlawyersforworkingwomen.org.
Would you repeat that one more time?
Sure. www.womenlawyersforworkingwomen.org.
And is that lawyers plural?
It is.
So we've got www.womenlawyersforworkingwomen.org.
Correct.
.org.
Yes.
Great. Jason, do you have some examples to give our listeners so we can understand this a little bit better?
Examples of gender bias or examples of ways to help?
Good question. Either one, but
such a lawyer. I'm so sorry.
You are. Yeah, no wonder you're the Young Attorney of the Year. My goodness. Okay. Actually, why don't you give us some ways to help?
Certainly. So two things I would suggest. One is that you contact your local representative and urge them to support AB, which stands for Assembly Bill 305. We often fall into using the lingo and forget that it may not make sense to people not familiar with how the Capitol and the legislature works. You can go online. There's a website that the state of California runs. findyourrep.legislature.ca.gov. And you can type in your address, and it will tell you exactly who your local representatives are if you don't already know, including the contact information for their offices, and you can reach out and ask that they support Assembly Bill 305. The other thing that we would ask on behalf of CAW is that if you out there listening are an injured worker and you yourself have suffered some sort of gender discrimination, whether male or female, you can reach out to our local CAW office, which is in Sacramento, and our website is www.caw, that's caaa.org, and get in touch with the local office, or it's local to me, I'm here in Sacramento, the CAW state office, and share your story. And, the more stories we have, the louder that speaks at the legislature. That's really what they listen to, are personal stories, and we're always looking for more of those.
Absolutely. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Applicants Attorneys Association and the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. This is our Call a Lawyer night. Once again, if you are listening live or streaming us live, please call our attorneys who are sitting there waiting at 1-800-525-9917. Once again, we have Jeff Hayden in criminal law, Janet Frankel, family law, Peter Fortune, legal malpractice law, Nathaniel Bigger, landlord-tenant, Charles Wish, employment law, Ron Rohde, patent and aviation law, Lemon Law, Better Business Bureau arbitration, and in bankruptcy, Leon Baer, who will take calls tomorrow, March 26th from 8 to noon at 1-800-477-3111. That's 1-800-477-3111. Thank you. We're back with our guests. Our topic is gender bias in the workplace. Jason, you have given us some great ideas. The findyourrep.legislator. What was it? One more time.
Findyourrep, all one word, .legislature.ca.gov.
Great. And
if you're technically inclined, I think you can just Google California Finders Legislator, and it'll link you to that website.
That sounds like a great idea. Do you have any more examples of gender bias in cases that you're familiar with?
Well, I would mention that these examples that we've been giving are usually by male doctors. In workers' compensation, the doctors are overwhelmingly male. And so, not to disparage at all male doctors, there are many fine male doctors, but there should be some parity amongst the state-appointed doctors in terms of gender. I did a search. I'm in the Inland Empire area, which is Ontario, about 45 miles east of Los Angeles. And in my particular area, we have 195 state-appointed orthopedic doctors, and only 5 of them are women.
Oh, my.
Yes.
What do you mean by state-appointed doctors?
So in order to become a panel-qualified medical evaluator, the doctor has to go through an entire process, things like education and testing, to be appointed as a state QME, as we call it. And what a QME does is, in the event that there is either some type of dispute over whether the work injury happened on the job or not, or if there is some dispute about what the final permanent disability, the residuals, what the compensation should be for residuals from the injury, then it's usually decided by a QME. And so the QMEs are assigned by the state of California. If one of the parties requests a QME, the state of California will send a list of three names. And depending on whether you're represented or unrepresented, it's a different track. But ultimately, one of the doctors is chosen off of that list.
What do you mean, a different track?
Yes, correct. So one of them is chosen to serve as the QME and will issue a narrative report indicating his or her opinions on things like permanent disability and the need for future medical and whether the injury was industrial, and coming full circle, the apportionment issue.
Now, do agreed medical examiners also comment on apportionment?
Yes, they do. If you are represented, then the parties may agree to a neutral doctor and not go through that QME process, but instead choose a doctor, usually who's local, who would then serve as the neutral doctor to arbitrate whatever the dispute may be, whether it is apportionment or the permanent disability, maybe the causation, whether it happened on the job or not. And unfortunately, we have a situation where many QMEs are AMEs, and so the percentage of female AMEs is also extremely small in this system.
Well, do I understand, Crystal, that whether you are seeing a QME or an AME or your treating doctor, some doctor is going to comment on apportionment in your case?
That's correct, and it is highly likely to be a man.
And it is highly likely to be prejudicial because you're a woman. Is that right?
It may be. Just as an example, one of the QMEs in a case of a female grape picker, she had a low back injury, she had a fusion surgery, and this male state-appointed doctor questioned her credibility and said, well, her pain level may be somewhat less than she claims because she became pregnant and was able to have a kid. So you have these perhaps stereotypes or innate gender biases that can perhaps come out in the medical report.
Well, I found a quote by Assembly Member Gonzalez, who I understand was the principal author of this bill we've been talking about. And she said that it's time to outlaw penalties against injured working women based on their gender. And it sounds like that kind of sums up what we're talking about. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, that's precisely what we're trying to do. Well, one of the things that as we've been looking into this issue, has really struck me as interesting is, you know, if you look throughout California statutes, there is prohibition against discrimination based on a sex or gender throughout numerous areas of California law, and yet there isn't such a prohibition in workers' compensation, and that's really the heart of what we're trying to do here is in some ways bring that area of workers' compensation law in sync with where the rest of the state is at. I don't think there's any question that the state of California, as a general policy, doesn't agree with and wants to eliminate any form of gender bias, and it's time for workers' compensation to catch up to that.
Thank you. It's now 7:29, and this is KALW, your local public radio station. The first half hour of this program has been recorded and sent to stations who will air this program delayed. For those of you who are calling who have questions for my guests on workers' compensation, any workers' compensation issue, please call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Crystal or Jason will be happy to answer your question. They cannot give specific legal advice, but they will try to point you in the right direction. Tonight, our topic is gender bias in the workplace. It's also Call a Lawyer Night, as you've heard me say before. The number to call for our Call a Lawyer people who are waiting for your call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Again, there is no obligation to call this number. You may talk to them off the air. They give their time as a public service. And we have with us tonight Jeff Hayden, Certified Specialist in Criminal Law, Janet Frankel, Certified Specialist Family Law, Peter Fortune, Legal Malpractice, he's a Certified Specialist, Nathaniel Bigger, Landlord-Tenant Law, Charles Wish, Employment Law, Ron Rohde, who does Patent Law, Aviation Law, Lemon Law, and is a Better Business Bureau Arbitrator. And once again, Leon Baer has graciously offered to have you call with regard to bankruptcy questions tomorrow, March 26th, from 8 to noon. He is at 1-800-477-3111. If you call and the line is busy, please leave a message with your name, phone number, and say you're a KALW listener, and he will be happy to call you back. This is, once again, your legal rights. My guests are Crystal Schoenfelder, a partner in the Ontario law firm of Rose, Klein & Marius, and co-founder and co-chair of Cause Women's Caucus. Jason Marcus, a partner in the Sacramento law firm of Marcus, Regalado, and Marcus, and a board member of CAW, also has been awarded the Young Attorney of the Year by the State Bar's Workers' Compensation Section. So we're back on the air. Is there anything more, Crystal and Jason, you want to add with regard to our topic, gender bias?
Well, the irony of Jason's statement about the statutes is that we actually currently have two statutes on the books in the labor code that say if the injured worker meets eligibility for payments from a fund that we call the subsequent injuries fund, quote, he shall be paid additional compensation. They haven't yet changed the statutory language to reflect the he or she gender-neutral language. And also, a form that is currently available on the Division of Workers' Compensation website, if you want to change attorneys or if you want to go from being pro per, representing yourself, to becoming represented by an attorney, it says he, it says his attorney instead of his or her attorney. So again, we don't have that gender neutral language in our own statutes and in our own workers' compensation forms.
And yet we're finding that gender neutral is becoming more and more common in every other place but the workplace, it seems like.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I do hope and I urge our listeners to contact their legislator for more information, to go to the www.womenlawyersforworkingwomen.org site for more information, to get involved. And as Jason mentioned, if you have a story where you felt you were discriminated against because of gender, whether you're male or female, one thing to do is to contact the California Applicants Attorneys Association state office and give them that information, and perhaps we can turn this around. Something that we have discussed in the past that is troublesome, frankly, to a lot of injured workers is medical care and what's happening to medical care in the comp system today. Would you be willing to address that for a little bit?
I would, and forgive me, Crystal, if I'm stepping on your toes. I want to bring something to our listeners' attention. There has been a series of stories that have recently ran by ProPublica. And you can find these on their website at www.propublica.org. And these stories have actually been run in conjunction with NPR, so there's the local tie. But the reporter for ProPublica has over a number of months done a nationwide look at the rollback, if you will, of workers' compensation benefits and rights that or the laws that protect workers' rights to obtain those benefits. And it's really striking the stories of how benefits have been pulled back over the years, how benefits have been taken away, and really the human impact it has had on injured workers as their benefits have been reduced or in some cases eliminated entirely. And I think, Alice, that ties in exactly with what you're talking about. Treatment, that's been one of the big pushes of that story, and it's been something that we in California have been dealing with, especially since the beginning of 2013, when the last California big workers' comp reform package, Senate Bill 863, was passed into law and significantly changed how we deal with the delivery of medical treatment and how we deal with disputes that arise over whether or not a recommended medical treatment is reasonable and necessary for a particular injured worker.
Absolutely. Crystal, do you have some comment on that?
Actually, I do. That's gender-based. There was a Senate concurrent resolution that was introduced by Senator Carol Liu, and one of the things that it said was that women have a higher prevalence than men of chronic pain syndromes, and women respond differently to certain analgesics. Now, in my practice, I have not seen any of the utilization review treatment denials discuss any type of distinctions between men and women regarding efficacy of medication. And I will admit that I have certainly not looked into it very much, but it is something that I would be curious to see if, in fact, that is something that we should pay attention to. We have guidelines that the doctors are supposed to follow to determine if treatment should be approved or not. And so if it doesn't follow those guidelines, then the treatment would be denied. Unfortunately, what we're seeing with treatment denials is that they're looking for medications that would cure the condition instead of relieving the condition. I've seen treatment denials that say there's no functional improvement. And so just from a gender point of view, if a woman does have a different effect regarding medications, then it is something we should certainly be looking into and maybe modifying the treatment schedule for that.
And tell me about the treatment schedule. What is this treatment schedule you're talking about?
So the administration passed some regulations. It was based on what we called the ACOM, A-C-O-E-M, guidelines initially, and then they adopted an entire treatment schedule that does incorporate quite a bit of those ACOM guidelines, and it essentially sets out what should be approved. So, for instance, if you have a specific type of surgery, then you may be entitled to X number of post-surgical therapy visits. And if you exceed those visits, the number of visits, then the treatment may not be approved. And so there are a variety of guidelines. They are usually pretty specific about the types of body parts or injuries or surgeries. And all the treatment requests have to go through the utilization review process.
That's any treatment request?
Any treatment request.
And what is this UR? Are these doctors that are local?
They are usually doctors who are out of state. They may not, in my experience, receive all of the necessary records to make a determination. And sometimes they will request more information. Other times they will just make a decision based on the records that they have. And just as a very simple example, we had a client who was a male injured worker who the doctor said needed a total knee replacement. And utilization review got the MRI from 2011, but not from 2013. And they denied it. Well, once we went to the board and raised the issue about the doctor not being provided with all of the records, the adjuster agreed, let's get all the records to the utilization review doctor, including the 2013 MRI. And once that happened, then the knee surgery was approved. But unfortunately, when treatment is denied, the denials are valid for up to a full year unless the circumstances change.
Wow. So, Jason, do you have something to add to this egregious situation here?
Well, yeah. The idea of a treatment guideline is, in theory, a good idea. I think it's important to have a roadmap or a framework to work within. The problem that we are seeing, or at least that I'm seeing in my practice, and I suspect Crystal would agree with me in her practice, is that these utilization review physicians are often applying these treatment guidelines not as a guideline that is point you in the right direction but open to some massaging, but as a very mechanical, very hyper-technical, almost as a straitjacket. And if the doctor hasn't completely crossed his or her T's or dotted his or her I's, the treatment is denied. So, for example, if the guideline says you need to, you know, show A, B, C, and D in order for this treatment to work, but the doctor only says why A, B, and C are met and then explains why D isn't met but why the treatment is still reasonable in this particular case, I will often see a utilization review physician nonetheless deny the treatment because all of the exact specific guidelines weren't met in that case. And look, I'm not a doctor, but from what I know, that there's an art to treating people and providing treatment. And sometimes I think that this utilization review process really takes away the art of medicine and sterilizes it to the point where I think it's negatively impacting my clients and injured workers throughout the state.
Is there something you can do if that's denied? Is there a remedy for you?
Well, there is. As part of SB 863 that went into effect in 2013, we have a dispute resolution process that we call independent medical review, or IMR, where if utilization review denies treatment, the injured worker or his or her attorney or his or her physician, the treating doctor, can request an independent medical review, in which case the file, the records, are sent off to a new physician, not someone that I choose, not someone that my client chooses, someone that is assigned anonymously by the state of California, who then does a second paper-only review. And when I say paper-only, I mean they don't evaluate my client face-to-face. They don't pick up the phone and talk to my client. They don't talk to anyone, frankly, these IMR reviewers. And then they issue a decision either approving the treatment, in other words, overruling the utilization review denial, or denying the treatment and upholding the utilization review denial. And that process, we are finding, is untenable from our perspective because we aren't able to challenge the underlying findings of an IMR decision. For example, if they missed a record, there's no remedy. There's no appeals process to effectively challenge that. Or if they made a mistake, it's very difficult to go into court and challenge the findings of the IMR physician.
And yet that decision is good for a year?
It is.
And most importantly for any of your listeners who may be injured workers, they only have 30 days from the treatment denial to appeal and file the application for the IMR, independent medical review, process. If they do not file within the time limits, there is no right to appeal, and that treatment denial is upheld for a year unless the circumstances change.
Well, I hope you listeners out there heard that that's 30 days from a denial in which to appeal. If you have questions for my guests, please call 415-841-4134. We have two very knowledgeable, very distinguished guests this evening, and if you have questions with regard to workers' compensation, this would be a perfect time for you to call and get good answers. We also have the Call a Lawyer Night tonight. And for those of you wanting to speak off the air to attorneys there, that number is 1-800-525-9917. Funding in part is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and by the California Applicants Attorneys Association. Both of my guests are members of both organizations, and it's just very enlightening to hear you talk about these things.
We've talked about SB 863, Senate Bill 863, that was passed in 2012 that implemented some of these changes like the independent medical review process. One other change that it implemented was an elimination of compensation for injured workers who suffer what we call a psychiatric compensable consequence. There are two exceptions to getting any type of compensation for that psychiatric disability, and that is if the injured worker has a catastrophic injury or is a victim of a violent act. Now, of note, neither of those terms have been defined yet by the court, and they weren't defined within the statute. But we have heard from the director of the Department of Industrial Relations, Christine Baker, that women file 64% of mental stress claims and 63% of mental disorder claims. So to eliminate the psychiatric compensable consequence could potentially have a disproportionate impact on women.
Tell me what psychiatric compensable consequence means.
So as an example, let's take a nurse who loves her job, loves to go to her job, loves to help people every day. She's lifting, and she has a back injury. And now the doctor has indicated that she can no longer do heavy lifting, and she can't go back to her job. And maybe because she's lost that it has created some depression or some anxiety. And so that's what we call a compensable consequence. She had an orthopedic injury, which has now resulted in additional psychiatric complaints. And before SB 863, you were entitled to compensation for both of the conditions, the orthopedic back injury as well as the psychiatric disability. But under SB 863, it says that you cannot get compensation for the psychiatric portion. You can get treatment, but you don't get compensated for that now.
Oh, okay. So we do have a caller. Bill, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question for my guests?
Yes, I do. I got a compromise and release from my attorney. And could someone explain that to me a little bit?
Certainly. I'll take a stab at that, Bill. Hi, by the way, this is Jason. So a compromise and release is a form of a settlement of a workers' compensation claim. And typically, and I say typically because each settlement can be different, but typically a compromise and release settlement is a full and final cash-out settlement where the insurance company agrees to give you a lump sum cash settlement, and in return for that, you agree to basically close the workers' compensation case and give up your right to any future benefits arising from that injury, whether disability payments or medical treatment or any other benefits that would be connected to that particular work injury.
So are the medical benefits included in that?
Typically, yes. In a compromise and release, you are giving up your right to future medical care in return for a cash payment from the insurance company. So again, in a typical compromise and release, once it's signed by you, your lawyer, the other side, and then approved by a workers' compensation judge, from the date that compromise and release is approved, you no longer have the right to seek or obtain medical treatment for your work injury at the expense of the workers' compensation insurance carrier.
Okay. What if I am receiving Social Security benefits? Does that affect the compromise and release, or does it affect my Social Security benefits?
Well, the answer is it might. Typically, Social Security, if you're getting Social Security disability benefits, is that what you're receiving, Bill?
Social Security retirement benefits.
Okay. Now, with the caveat that I am a workers' compensation lawyer and not a Social Security lawyer, my understanding is that a workers' compensation compromise and release settlement does not have an effect on your Social Security retirement benefits. But to be sure, you might want to reach out to either the Social Security Administration or a lawyer who specializes in Social Security law.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you. You've cleared it up for me a lot.
Thanks for your call, Bill. And we have another caller, Bob. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I'm wondering about if someone's injured on the job, how important is it to get a lawyer and what kind of lawyer? And I hear a lot about specialization. What's involved in lawyers becoming specialists in workers' comp? I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you. Okay. Who wants to handle this one?
Crystal, you want that?
Well, I can certainly talk about the specialization. You have to take a test in order to become a legal specialist in workers' compensation, and you have to demonstrate a variety of things that you have handled trials and you have handled a certain number of hearings before the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. You have to prove that you have certain knowledge of the workers' compensation system.
And there's also peer review, isn't there? Some peer review that's involved in this?
That is correct.
Yeah.
When do you think a person needs to get an attorney? And I'm assuming that we recommend that a certified specialist is usually good because you know they have a proficiency in the topic. It's such a complicated system that it's always good to get somebody who has demonstrated this proficiency. But when do you recommend that people actually get attorneys? Do you need one in every single case?
Well, I always say that it is first and foremost an injured worker's preference if they want an attorney involved. There are times that I have found in speaking with injured workers that they may not need an attorney representative. They may have received all of their treatment. They may have gone back to work. They may have healed. And if there is a settlement, they can feel hopefully confident that the settlement is being approved by a judge, and a judge at the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board is looking after their best interests. As you said, it is a very complicated system, and so if they are not getting benefits, they may not understand why, or they may not understand how to get those benefits going. For instance, as I stated earlier, the utilization review treatment denials. You have to be timely with those appeals, or you completely lose your right to appeal. And people may not understand that, and that is where an attorney could certainly help them navigate through the system.
Do you get any, do they cut you any slack if you are not represented? Or does this, for example, the 30 days, does it still apply whether you're represented or not?
It applies whether you are represented or not, and it is my understanding that those forms currently are only printed in English. So if we have some monolingual non-English speakers who are injured workers, they may not be able to understand those forms and understand that their legal rights could be affected.
What if I don't have any money? Does it cost to get a workers' compensation attorney?
Does not cost out of pocket. It is usually an amount, a percentage, generally 12 to 15% of the settlement once the case settles, and a judge has to approve any fees that an attorney asks for.
Right. We call that, Alice, a contingency fee, which means that the fee that I receive or that Crystal receives is contingent upon there being a settlement that includes some sort of monetary award to be paid to the injured worker. If the case settles and there's no money owing, in most cases Crystal and I aren't going to get paid. Also understand that both Crystal and I and just about every other applicant attorney, that is an attorney that represents injured workers that I know, we all offer free consultations. So when a worker, an injured worker, comes into my office for the first time for the initial meeting, one of the first things I tell them is there's no charge for this time, no matter whether we make the decision that you want to hire me or I want to take your case, because I want them to be at ease to know that there's not a clock running and that at the end of our conversation I'm going to hand them a bill. Most of our clients, frankly, couldn't afford if they had to pay us hourly fees.
And that's true generally, that an attorney on a workers' compensation case cannot charge a fee until it has been approved by a judge. Is that
correct? That's mandated by the state of California.
Okay. We have touched on another item in the past that I think is important for people to know, and that is about reporting your injury, that one needs to report it to a supervisor. Am I correct about that? As soon as it happens, can you address reporting injuries for a couple of minutes here?
Sure. In my opinion, the best practice is when you get hurt on the job or think you may have been hurt or are worried that you've been hurt, you should tell your supervisor, maybe it's a manager, depending on the size of the employer, there may be a dedicated human resources person or even department that you would go to. You know, if you work for a small shop, it may be just finding the boss and telling the boss that you got hurt. But yes, I encourage people to report injuries, and once the injury has been reported and the employer gains knowledge of that injury, and that knowledge can be from any source, whether from a supervisor, a coworker, the employer actually, you know, a supervisor seeing the injury happen, once the employer has knowledge, they have to give that injured worker a claim form, which is a one-page document that the worker fills out and then the employer fills out some information. That's what starts the claim process, is that claim form.
Now, some employees may not understand that there are two types of injuries in workers' compensation. One is a specific injury. So something happens at a specific moment. For instance, they lift something heavy and they feel a twinge in their back, or they slip and fall. But the other type of injury is what we call a repetitive trauma injury. And sometimes that confuses employees because they're not sure if it is a work injury or not. And then if they report it to their employer, what I have heard some injured workers say is that the employer asked me to put a specific date. And they may have experienced symptoms for a few months over time, and it just built up to the point that they said, I think I have a work injury, or their doctor told them they had a work injury and they need to report it. If that should happen, you can put a specific date if that's what the employer asks, or you could explain that this is what we call a repetitive trauma that has happened over time.
Thank you so much. This has been a very interesting program. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights with my guests, Crystal Schoenfelder and Jason Marcus. Thank you both for appearing on the program. The Legal Rights Program Engineer tonight is Joanne Marr. Production Assistant is Martin McLean. Next week, on April Fool's Day, please join Chuck Finney on Your Legal Rights for the topic, Don't Be Fooled by Scams. Chuck's guests will be Jay White, a pro bono attorney with the Legal Aid Society of San Mateo County, and Joseph Rideout, Consumer Services Manager for Consumer Action. Funding has been made possible by California Applicants Attorneys Association, by the California Board of Legal Specialization, by the San Mateo County Bar Association, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the Family Law Sections, Trust and Estate Sections, and Labor and Employment Sections of the State Bar. Thank you for listening to Your Legal Rights. Sitting in for vacationing Chuck Finney, I am Alice O'Sullivan.